Finishing up Genesis chapter 19. It was gnarly last Wednesday. Last Wednesday was not gnarly. It was kind of fun. It was the Wednesday before that that was gnarly. Feeling a little bit disorganized in my thought. We really don't have that much to go in chapter 19. Maybe this will be short. And maybe not. But we left off in Genesis chapter 19 is, as you know, God was ready to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is the first major judgment in the scriptures where an entire peoples were annihilated. And at the very hand of God. And so we see also that in God's judgment, back in chapter 18, that God is righteous and he is completely fair, if we would use that word. He is not going to judge somebody who is righteous before him. And of course, I mean, this comes all the way around to the cross because the fact is we are all guilty before him and deserve judgment, and that explains the cross. And so Jesus came to the cross. He took our punishment upon himself, and those of us who believe we are righteous before him, therefore we will not be judged. We know that 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 9 says that God does not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through Jesus Christ. And so, with that said, there were still righteous people in the Old Testament before Christ, and they were righteous because of the way Abraham found his righteousness, and that is he believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. They believed God's promises. They believed God is merciful. They depended upon his mercy. And so in that belief, then, there were those who were righteous. And so regarding having their sins paid for, well, I would say that those in the Old Testament that were righteous before God receiving his grace, they definitely got it on credit because Jesus would pay that debt for them. And so this being a picture of God's fairness, of God's righteousness, and the fact is that he had to judge Sodom and Gomorrah because they had reached a point of no return. We see that point of no return in Romans chapter 1, where God gives them up to a debased mind. God gives up people. And so there came a point where if Sodom and Gomorrah were to last any longer, certainly they would influence others in the world. Or they would procreate and make more people to populate hell with. And so God wipes them out. And that's what's happening here. Problem is, there's some righteous people in there. And I love it, you know, as we learn from Peter, 2 Peter, that Lot's righteous. And we talked about this 2 weeks ago. And it blows my mind that Lot would be called righteous because, boy, does he look pretty worldly. Which means there's hope for so many Christians today, worldly Christians. I know, some of you say, maybe you shouldn't say that because some people are living really bad and now you're making it okay for them. There's nothing okay with making a profession of faith in the Lord and then walking in the world. Either that is proof that you never made the profession, or you're going to suffer big time here while God is dragging you everywhere he needs to drag you. Speaking of drag you everywhere he needs to drag you, that's what happened to Lot. The angels, two angels came into the city, and we saw in the first part of chapter 19, we witness the wickedness. We see the sexual sin running rampant, the homosexuality and the banging on the doors. And then we see Lot doing that horrible, stupid thing, saying, no, take my daughters instead. And so Lot had been in the gate of the city, which meant he was probably on city council. And also he had been influenced by just the worldliness, naturally, of Sodom, and thought it was totally okay to give up his daughters in order to protect his guests, those angels that came in. And the angels told him, hey, we're going to judge the place. But, well, let's pick it up in verse 15. I know we went all the way to 18 or 19 or 20. I don't even know how far we got last time. We'll pick it up in verse 15, okay? When the morning dawned, now the angels have been just trying to tell him, hey, we're going to, God's going to smoke the place, and we've got to get you out of here before he does. And, you know, Lot told his son-in-laws, and they thought he was joking. That tells you a little bit more about Lot. You know, Lot's talking about holy things, and they think he's joking. Well, when the morning dawned, verse 15, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. So it came to pass when they had brought them out outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. And then Lot said to them, please know, my lords, indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said to them, See, I have favored you concerning this thing also, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. Boy, you know, I'm just having so much thought up here as I was reading that had nothing to do with any of the thought I had all day today going through this. So, I hope I remember when I get there. All right. So, Lot lingered. It was a tough thing for the angels to talk him into getting out of there. Till finally, of course, the angels grabbed Lot, his wife, and his two daughters, and they each grabbed a hand. We had two angels there, so each of them could grab a hand. And they dragged them out, seemingly against their will. And then they told him, okay, now you run to the mountains, go. And he didn't want to go to the mountains. Why? Why didn't Lot want to go to the mountains? Well, mountains, certainly we're going to see later, they're going to be living in a cave up in the mountains. It meant seclusion. They were leaving the big city. He says, if I go there, I'll die. Perhaps he feared a life without the hustle and bustle and the entertainment and the distraction of Hollywood. I mean, I've had people come visit me here in Fort Bragg, people who are in the ministry, and they will ask me, how do you live here? How can you do this? Well, what do you mean, how can I do this? They say, there's no mall. They've said that. There's no mall here. Yeah, you're right. There's no mall here. How do you live? I'd go crazy. This would kill me. You know, it's interesting. Lot wanted to live, but I think maybe, and I'm speculating here, but maybe he just didn't think it was possible to live without his cell phone. You know, whatever the world has given us and how we go about our business. No, cell phones are not evil and wicked, except it's kind of funny what they've done to us. But you know what I'm saying. You know my point, I hope. You know, while Sodom and Gomorrah was a wicked place, it was familiar to him. And it was entertaining. And it was tough to give up all that stuff. Interesting thing, Jeremiah chapter 45. In Jeremiah, the entire book is dedicated to Babylon's siege on Jerusalem and taking them away, taking Judah away into Babylon. And Jeremiah was the only guy that was speaking the truth. And a guy by the name of Baruch was his scribe. And we see the strangest thing in Jeremiah 45, just out of nowhere, tiny little chapter. Some of you are familiar with this. God suddenly speaks to Baruch and says, you know, you seek great things for yourself. Don't seek them. He says, disaster is coming on this place. I'm going to give you your life as a prize. I'm giving you your life. That's your prize. I think it's hard for us to grasp these things. Like with Lot, like Baruch, like us. We can miss the most important things while we're trying to hold on to that which will never last anyway. We're holding on to things or seeking after things. I know you and I have plans in this world. But really so many of the plans that we have in this world and we're asking God to bless have everything to do with this world. And they have nothing to do with God. Jesus had said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? But we snap back. Well, can't we have both? Why can't we just gain the whole world? Doesn't God want me to gain the whole world and save my soul? It just doesn't work that way. The Bible doesn't teach it. And so, as Baruch was being addressed by God, don't seek a great name for yourself. Don't seek greatness for yourself. Stop seeking stuff for yourself. Stop seeking yourself. Seek God. And just as it is in this world, as God did with Egypt, as he had sent the plagues there, and then he did with, Jerusalem, when Babylon came, and you know, there's always a remnant of believers that escaped with their lives. And so the world is today. And there are a remnant of believers that are going to escape. And you know what I'm not going to be bringing with me? That piano. No matter what, you know. And we get a lot of pleasure out of things that really don't matter. It's not sin. We have a lot of pleasure out of things. They're not sin at all. But when it becomes an attachment, and we think that's what life is, heck, I mean, peanut butter could be a sin. For those of you who think that life's all about peanut butter. I was telling my wife, you know, sometimes I just keep that gate wide open, and whatever word is in my head, it falls right out of my mouth, and I can't tell you why peanut butter was there, but it was there. But we are going to escape with our lives and with that only if we belong to him, because what's inside is what lasts forever. And Lot, you know, he was afraid of losing maybe all the shopping or something that was, you know, or maybe Lot, as he says, I can't go to the mountains, I'll die. I just had this thought today. After reading through this a billion times throughout my Christian walk and having studied it before, I just thought of this today now. Maybe Lot was afraid that he would die off. What? Die off. You see, he was instructed to go up to the mountains. There were no people there. And he had a wife and two daughters. If the daughters can't find a man, there ain't going to be nothing. There's not going to be anything for Lot. And he will die off. And maybe going to Zoar, that small little place, it's like, okay, now I can still get what I want and still be away from the really bad stuff, but I can still get what I want and be obedient to God all at the same time. What a great deal. The angel gave him permission. Okay, you can go to Zoar. Which, by the way, Zoar means little. It was a little city, but it had men, young men. And so the angels give the permission. You know what this tells me? Is that God will never force us to have the best. God will never force us to have the best. And we can still belong to God without having the best. In Numbers chapter 32, when the 12 tribes of Israel were wandering around the wilderness, they were getting ready to go into the promised land. It was there on the east side of the Jordan that the tribe of Reuben said, "We like it here. We don't want to keep going. We don't want to go to where God had planned for us to go, to that real fruitful place, because this place looks fruitful enough. And it looks good for us. There's a lot of, you know, good place for cattle. And we, you know, we're into our cattle." And Moses made a deal with them, saying, "Okay, you can stay here." And it all looked okay, but they ended up having misunderstandings. They ended up having problems. They were still of the 12 tribes of Israel, but they created problems for themselves by going halfway with God. And so there's Lot. Here he is. They finally convinced him that he's got to escape for his life. And they pull him out and they say, "Run to the mountains." And he says, "Wait a minute. I have a request. It's this thing that we do so often in prayer. We say, "Oh God, not your will, but mine be done." And in every approach to God, or should I say every approach God comes to us, when every time God approaches us, that we would come up with our suggestions for a better life for us. Man. I'm all over it. I always tell God what I want, right? I don't know what, boy. I tell you what would be really good for me, God. Now, this, by the way, I've talked about this before. We're going to talk about it again, and I'm going to keep flip-flopping back and forth between these two different pictures, and one of them is the picture of the rapture of the church, because what's happening, God is judging, and before he judges, he pulls out his people. And so, as we even know, as Jesus said in Luke 17, 28 through 30, likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. And so that's the case. And this is why I believe that that the church will be raptured, taken away, taken out before God pours out his wrath on this planet. And so we know that this is a picture of judgment and the rapture of the church. But also, it's a picture of the choices that all people are given before judgment comes. In that there are things that would hold us back. There are things that hold the world back. There are people that don't, or they're not interested in the Lord, or people who, yeah, they go to church and I'm good with that, but there's something about them that still just does not really want the Lord. And the question is, you know, what is it that holds a person back? What is it that will hold you back from eternal life? Like the rich young ruler, right? For him, it was his money. But you know, you witness to people, you share the truth with them, and they'll say, well, you know, that sounds like a cool thing, but I just can't do that, or I'm not ready. You ever hear that one? I'm not ready. What do you do? You gotta put your shoes on, your makeup? What do you mean you're not ready? And what they're really saying is that there's still a sin in my life that is more important to me than eternity. And that's really the case. This is why people don't come to faith in the Lord, because they have to give up things they don't want to give up. And so the Lord speaks to everybody in the whole world, and he wants the whole world to come out. He says, get out of there. Go. You say, well, I don't know. I don't know. You say you're going to blow the place up? Yes! Well, I'm going to stay because I like them all. You see how foolish all of this really is. By the way, there's another thing it's just like, what's going on here? Notice that the angels said, they grabbed him and they pulled him out. And then they said, now you use your feet and get up to those mountains. At which point, I believe that's a picture of Israel in the tribulation. Because Jesus tells them they're supposed to run and head for the mountains. But I also see it as salvation. Funny little thing I see when I look at Acts chapter 12. When Peter is in prison, there he is. He's stuck in prison. He's all bound up. He's sleeping because that's what he does. And then an angel shows up and he strikes him, wakes him up, and he wakes up and the chains are off. But then the angel says, now, get on your feet and walk. Follow me. Which tells me, as you see throughout all of the scriptures, God does the miracle of grabbing you, yanking you out, but then he says, all right, now I want you to use your feet to be obedient to me. We have responsibility in this. Now don't go thinking that we make ourselves free by obeying. Because when we obey, I'm a firm believer that it was God doing the obeying through us. But we've got to will in our own hearts to obey. And so just like Peter got knocked and the chains fell off, the angels grab these guys, yank them out, they let go and say, now go that way. And so what does Lot do with his go that way? Well, I only want to go this far. Because he had a lot of good reasons, didn't he, for not wanting to go all the way up to the mountains, for not being completely obedient to the Lord. Everybody's got such great reasons for not believing God is in it for them. But I am telling you, God seeks the best for you and me. And if we are obedient and use our feet to walk with God, we will see that best. But if we sit around and ponder and start weighing our options, then that is to say, God, I don't believe you have the best in mind for me. I am going to choose my best for me. And for the rest of it, I give to you. So this is who we're dealing with, Lot. We can just criticize Lot left and right. And we feel funny, though, criticizing him because he looks so much like us. Okay. So then the sun, verse 23. The sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. So they came in at night, and as the sun was coming up, that's when they dragged them out. And then they went into Zoar, that next city. So this was after wrestling all night wrestling with God. When we get to chapter 32, we'll see Jacob wrestling with God too. And, you know, as a believer, we all wrestle with God to one degree or another, don't we? And that wrestling really is between our will and His. And God is faithful to... My apologies for my unfortunate choice of words, but God is faithful to cheat if He has to. As He does with Jacob, He breaks his hip. And so, you know, I know some of you, God doesn't cheat. I know. Sometimes God will force His will upon us because we're just too slow. But that forcing of His will can sometimes come in the form of pain. And so, anyway, all night it went, all night wrestling. And then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. And so He overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But His wife looked back behind Him, and she became a pillar of salt. We'll get the pillar of salt in a second. By the way, there is a... recently, actually, they found the area that they had believed. It was all the way... Actually, it was... what I read is 1973, when they found what they believed to be Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, now, according to some friends of mine who have been out there, they have this entire archaeological dig where this is it. This is Sodom. And you could read about it on the internet. There's a lot of information on that. And God, brimstone, be like sulfur, like all kinds of... crazy flammable things. Some people, what is it? Bitumen. I can't say that word. Bitumen? B-I-T-U-M-E-N. Anybody know how to say that? No. All right. Well, God bless y'all. And but it's like tar pits and stuff. And some commentators suggest that all of this Sodom and Gomorrah area was, you know, kind of where the tar pits. If you go back to chapter 14, and you know, when they got in the fights and the tar pits, you know, and that this was extremely flammable, and that God used a lot of that to burn them up. Now, I don't know. We don't need explanations. You know, I say, you know, you can get all kinds of videos and stuff, like on the Red Sea crossing, right? You know, divers found this corridor, you know, paved with you know, laminate flooring, and down on the, you know, and it was just raised, so God had to just part the sea just a little bit like that and bring the tide down just a little bit, and then they're walking on this corridor. In fact, I think it was like a walk, one of those moving sidewalks, like in the, and they ended up, and you know, and they show us all these things and say, wow, this is how God did it. And certainly it would be a miracle if God put a moving sidewalk on the bottom of the sea. But why not just take God's word as it is? Because if God can do anything, well, this is heavy. You might want to write this down. If God can do anything, then He can do anything. Man, I'm gonna write that down. Make a meme out of that one. All right. What we have here is just God poured down fire on them. This is indeed God's judgment. It is a foreshadowing of judgment to come on this planet. As we see the shadows and pictures all over the Old Testament of things to come, we read about Babylon going down. And when we talk about Babylon in Revelation, Revelation chapter 18, you know, you could say that it's a specific place, but I do believe it just speaks of the world and the world system. Revelation chapter 18, verses 2 through 5. He cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great has fallen, has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Interesting thing about this description of Babylon, and if you want more information on this and the timing of all of this and maybe some of the confusion of the timing of this, I would encourage you to maybe get the CD from Revelation chapter 18 that I did. We did that years ago now. But anyway, but there's something that strikes me regarding this Babylon, this world system, the world being destroyed in a moment like that, much like Sodom and Gomorrah. It says that the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath, and they've been made to be drunk. The world is made drunk by Babylon. And I started thinking about that. You know, you can't get drunk just sitting in a bar. You know, another heavy, I'm full of heavy information. You can go to a bar and sit there all day and never get drunk. You have to drink it to get drunk. It has to get in you to get drunk. You have to put it inside. And the problem in the world, and I think that with even so many Christians, as we live here in Babylon today, is that while we're trying to understand what it means to come out of Babylon, what really it's got to mean for us is that Babylon better come out of us. We've got to get Babylon out of us, because we just cannot physically get away. Interesting thing, you ever hear of the Rastafarian religion, right? You ever hear of the Rastafarians? These guys, they smoke the ganja and they play reggae music. And the whole world is Babylon. Babylon is evil and horrible. In fact, you might find some people down in Mendocino who are Rastafarians. They have their dreadlocks. They're stoned, and they'll look you straight in the eye and tell you that if you have a job, you're into Babylon and you are evil. And then they'll say, can I have some of your money? Okay, so I don't want to be a Rastafarian. But it's like the same message, get out of Babylon, right? And what I think we all refuse to understand, or maybe we understand it here, because if you've gone to this church for any longer than a few months, is that everybody, we are all Babylonian by nature. We're sinners by nature. And so the answer is to be born again. But even after being born again, we can still have such an affection for Babylon. And it can still be just in there fighting. And that is then our answer, I guess our answer for that is once we're born again, it's like the Lord grabbing us and pulling us out. But then he says, now use your feet. I want you to walk with me now. And he gives us the ability to do so. And so we are to, as believers, as we live in this Babylon, as we get caught up in this Babylon so easily, we are then to feed the Spirit and also find satisfaction in the Lord. I love it how I, seriously, this is a strange kind of love, but I love it how I get involved in so many different things that are just really, you know, it's not of the Lord, but it's fun stuff. But I'll experience like, you know, like, okay, well, that was like eating a Twinkie. You know, it has no value. Well, sorry, Twinkies do have value. But but it's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like just like eating stuff that doesn't do it, doesn't really fill you, and it doesn't nourish you. And it was so awesome. See, you're always just drawn back to the Lord. And it's such a wonderful rest to just then just sit there with the Lord and going, hey, remember me? And to just be filled with Him. And you really do understand that you belong to Him. And that's the best place. It is the best place. And so, if we are madly in love with our Babylon here, understand that it is going down. It's going to go up in smoke. And we've got to make that choice, even in our hearts today, to not, you know, to let, get that Babylon out of us or come out of Babylon. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Or godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, meanwhile, so here they are. They're told, don't look back and don't be. And here comes Mrs. Lot. And she was running behind Lot. So they're all dragged out. And so they're all at the starting line. Now they're to run. Now, she is behind him, so he's still running faster than she is. And she turns around and she looks back. Now, if you look at the Hebrew here, it does suggest that it wasn't just like a look back to see the explosion, but rather it was a longing, a gazing. And it's interesting, I sometimes talk with Christians and they light up when they talk about their party days. And I worry about them. They, you know, they'll say, oh yeah, man, you know, love hanging out with the fellowship. It's awesome, you know. Yeah, I was in the Word and God's talking to me. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody will walk by and they reek of pot or whatever, and they'll say, yeah, I used to party a lot, man. One time, you know what I did? And they're going for it. Like it was, you know, and it's like they miss it and they speak so fondly of it. You should look back at your old life. See, I see it as like somebody else that I used to know. And sometimes I take a step back and look at him and I feel sorry for him. But you see, Lot's wife, as you read more into Luke chapter 17, after Jesus says it was in the days of Lot, everybody was doing this, and hey, when it all goes down, you run. And then he says, Luke 17:32, remember Lot's wife. Don't forget her. She turned into salt. Now, did she turn into a statue of salt? Did she turn into just a pillar? And then they brought her to Mono Lake? Or, don't you love Mono Lake? And the first time I saw that, all I could think about was, I didn't know he had so many wives. But really, even the word pillar, it speaks of like a mound of salt. And you know, we get all these pictures and things and say, well, that's silly and that's crazy, you know, that God would do that. It could very well be that she just like disintegrated and turned into a pile of salt at that very spot. And just like a pile of it. She didn't have to be a pillar. It could have been a pile. And it doesn't really matter one way or the other. But this is what strikes me, is that as she ran behind and she turned, I am learning that the Hebrew language was that it was almost, and it could very well be, that she actually turned back to get something, or to turn back to go back. And that what happened to her was from the fallout of the fire. And that as those like you read about or see the pictures even, people who were buried in Pompeii with the volcano. They're buried in all of that, and they found him just intact like this. And it could be that she was suddenly encased in, I guess, salt or some sort of salt. Obviously, we can make something of the salt here. See, because people just say, why salt? Well, Jesus says that if, salt loses its flavor, it's good for nothing but to throw out into the streets, right? Well, if you throw salt into the streets, it'll make the snow melt for sure, but that's all it does. It's really good for nothing. And if it falls into your garden, your plants won't grow. And if I might, I would make application that if you and I are so wrapped up in the world, then we're going to be about as useful as salt, where no fruit grows, where nothing grows, and we're good for nothing but to be thrown into the streets. Now, some of you are saying, yeah, but Jesus said, have salt in yourself. Have your speech be seasoned with salt. Seasoned with salt. Not be a salt lick. Too much salt. I'm talking big time salt. You can ruin anything with too much salt. And that's what she was, too much salt. And she was useless. And that leaves us now with three people. That would be Lot and his two daughters. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. Then he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land, which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And I wonder what he was thinking, because he had to have been brokenhearted, scared, whatever, thinking, I wonder if he got out. I wonder if Lot got out. I hope he did. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. And so, verse 29 is just really a summary of everything just went down. And so we remember the prayer, and we learn from all of this, and we learn from Lot's attitude, we learn from Lot's slowness, that God's mercy goes far beyond our imagination of his mercy. It goes way beyond our imagination. You and I are maybe just me. I can be so completely unmerciful. I have no compassion for people sometimes. I see people and I make my judgment on them. People tell me they're Christians, and I don't think they're walking accordingly. And I think, well, certainly you're really not a Christian. Well, look at Lot. And be thankful for God's mercy. Because I know for every person that I would snuff out, that's God's thumb doing ants. Every person that I would snuff out, fact is, I ought to be snuffed out too. God is way more merciful than we think he is. And I am so happy about that. And we know the whole thing with the prayer. You know, Abraham started with 50 back in chapter 18. You're not going to wipe it out if there's 50 the people there, the righteous people. No, I won't do it. And he keeps getting them down, all the way down to 10, you know, and maybe hoping for converts, you know. Maybe 10 people could influence God not to blow that place up. I don't know if he was thinking that God would go there and get them out. But what's so good about all of this is that God doesn't see, as you and I see, God doesn't see in groups of 50. He sees individuals. And if you are the only Christian left in Fort Bragg would still live because of you. One of you. And it could be you're just like Lot. Might even be hard to tell you're a Christian. But God sees individuals. He doesn't see groups. Yes, he looks on the whole church, but we are one. And he sees us as individuals. But, you know, he doesn't look out over the black community or the Mexican community, the homosexual community, that, you know, all these different communities. And we have to have a heart for this community. Forget it. We've got to have hearts for individuals. Because God sees individuals. He sees you. And he sees me. He saw Lot. And then Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains with his two daughters, and his two daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar, and he and his daughters dwelt in a cave. Does anybody else see that that's a funny verse? Okay, good. You're paying attention. That's darn funny. That's up there. Lot is about as inconsistent as anybody I've ever met. And I've met a lot. Man, he doesn't know what he wants. But he has a hard time trusting God. And so he'll go this way for a little bit. And he'll go this way for a little bit. Oh, God, can I have this? Can I have this? It's like a 3-year-old kid. Hey, can I have a peanut butter sandwich? And you make him the peanut butter sandwich. You hand it to him. And he says, can I have tuna sandwich instead? You ever have a 3-year-old do that? By the way, he's playing you. Do not let him eat a tuna sandwich. I think we play God. You know, where we're playing him. We're saying, well, you know, God, I would do this. And you think, okay, God says, fine. And then you realize, well, this isn't very smart. Okay, well, maybe I will go and do this. Whew, back to God's patience. He's way more patient than I am. He's way more merciful than I am. Incredible God. And there's Lot. Maybe he's figuring it out, right? He's afraid. Look at verse 19 again. He says, I can't escape to the mountains. Some evil overtake me and I'm going to die. I'm going to die in the mountains. Verse 30. And Lot went up to the mountains because he was afraid to dwell in Zoar. Maybe the people, check it out. I'm making this up. Maybe the people of Zoar were like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Maybe not just so bad. They were getting there. And Lot thinking, this is not a good place. Maybe he was looking for husbands for his daughters in this little city, and he couldn't find any because the men there didn't want women. Lot realizing, you know what? Maybe I ought to just obey God. Oh, what a wonderful time in our lives when we just go ahead and say, after a little failure here and there, well, maybe I ought to just obey God. What freedom. So they're dwelling in a cave, him and his daughters. Now, just when it should have ended, the chapter should end here. Now the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old. There's no man on the earth to come into us as is the custom of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." So they made their father drink wine that night. The firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Happened on the next day that the firstborn said to the younger, "Indeed, I lay with my father last night. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. You go in and lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." And then they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Boy, you can take a person out of Sodom, but you can't take the Sodom out of a person. There they are, just, you know, thinking as stupidly as they can. By the way, nowhere here, do you see anywhere here at all where it says, "and God was displeased," or "and this was sin," or "this was a bad thing"? No, it's just stating the facts, ma'am. That's all it is. So much of the Old Testament is just telling us the history. And we read it, and we figure out, as we keep reading, this is bad. Now, anybody reading this part right here that can't see that it's bad right off, call me, we'll have an appointment. We need to talk. We need to have a talk. I think it was just rooted very deep in them and just, you know, having no clue what is right or wrong. Or these, you know, they're just going to go ahead and manipulate it, you know, or maybe even rationalize it, justify it, just say, "Well, we have to do this," the girl's talking, "we have to do this, God would want us to do this because there's no other way to do this." Anyway, Lot had no problem getting drunk with his daughters, and I guess he was a blackout drunk. Two nights in a row. This is disgusting. This is one of the grossest things in the scriptures. That man nor woman are, man or woman, are, they're not incapable of the most hideous sins. I mean, they just do the, it's amazing what people will do. I just read, see, I read, I see these headlines and I read the articles. A woman in Pakistan burned her daughter alive, set her on fire because she married a man she didn't want her to marry. They eloped and her mother actually contacted her and said, "I know you're afraid that I would hurt you for this, but I promise I'm not going to hurt you. We'll go ahead and have a party. I totally accept this." And she lured her daughter back and set her daughter on fire. Man is capable of the most hideous sins. The heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Man. And so, yeah, you can either read the Bible and see history, or you can read the newspaper. And you're going to see the grossest stuff you ever imagined. And thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn, a son, called his name Moab, and he's the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the people of Ammon to this day. The Moabites and the Ammonites. You want to see trouble? They lived on the east side of the Jordan. And it was there that we see just some of the worst fighting. It's where in Numbers where we find Balaam and the donkey and Balaam trying to curse them because the king, Balak, king of the Moabites, hired Balaam to curse Israel. And it was them, and then they got together with the Midianites. And they came in to the camp with the women and got them involved in sexual sin. And there's a plague. It was horrible. I mean, you see that these people, the Moabites and the Ammonites, well, they were enemies of Israel for as long as they lived. You don't know how far your sin goes, do you? Generation after generation after generation, the Moabites and the Ammonites fought against God's people. Back to chapter 16, right? With the Ishmaelites and the Arabs. Even to this day, Muslims fighting against God's people. You don't know how far your sin is going to travel. Well, the good news is God is patient. God is merciful. Be sure you know the Lord tonight. Be born again. And come out of Babylon and ask the Lord to help you get Babylon out of you. And, and then be baptized on Sunday. If you haven't been baptized, we're doing that this Sunday. Father, thank you. It's just amazing, Lord, how you would impute your righteousness on people like Lot. We thank you so much for giving us that righteousness. But Lord, as you have pulled us out of the fiery furnace, we all right now would ask you to help us to walk. Teach us what it is to be obedient. Lord, if you tell us to go to the mountains, I pray that we wouldn't just go halfway. Lord, we don't want to be a study in halfway obedience. Thank you so much, Lord, that you want the best for us. Oh, Lord, may we seek you with the same fervency that you seek us. And we receive the best. We love you. And we thank you for your grace and mercy. In Jesus' name, amen.